This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. It was 8 years ago this week that Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast. The storm killed more than 1,800 people and displaced thousands more. The devastation is still with us. There was lots of talk at the time about the unexpectedness of Katrina's magnitude. Government officials, news anchors, and experts told the public they had no way of knowing it would be that bad. Some residents doubted the severity of the storm as well.
They said, well, we got to leave. The hurricane coming. I said, listen, man, everybody who's afraid should leave. But I ain't for that leaving. I'm going to stay right here.
But in the early 80s, a research team convened to analyze the impact of tropical storms in New Orleans. Madhu Berriwal was part of that team. And today, she says, that research foretold much of the ruin that occurred in 2005. Madhu Berriwal is the founder and CEO of Innovative Emergency Management and my guest on the State of Things today. Welcome. It's good to have you here.
Hi, Frank. Nice to be here.
Tell us about your work doing floodplain research in New Orleans in 2005.
So I graduated with a master's degree in urban planning, and the first job I took on was as a floodplain management coordinator for the state of Louisiana. And the state of Louisiana does have a little bit of a problem with flooding. And having the mighty Mississippi River that flows through the state. And so I had a chance to visit a lot of different communities around Louisiana talking about how to deal with floods, how to do better planning, especially floodplain management, so we didn't have so many catastrophic floods. And then in the early 80s, I had a chance to be the program manager for a hurricane evacuation study for the New Orleans area. And I took that position even though that meant giving up my full-time permanent civil service job at the state and going on a grant-funded project, essentially. But I was very intrigued by that, having grown up in Calcutta and have seen cyclones, that, and I wanted to get involved in that and see if I could make a difference in being better prepared for hurricanes. So we worked for about 2 years with the nine parishes, as the counties are called in Louisiana. And we worked to look at all of the scientific data, the technical information on what could happen if a storm of a certain magnitude struck New Orleans. What would be the effect and how long would it take to evacuate the people that were at risk?
Well, it's interesting, the set of problems that you're dealing with. I mean, on the one hand, there's trying to figure out what is the magnitude, how bad is this storm, because that's something that you'd like to convey. But then there's this other question of preparedness, just being ready for any disaster, and we don't know how bad it is, but you all need to get out. And I think this latter question was the one that you were dealing with. How can we prepare our infrastructure and our communications to be ready to get people to move when the time comes? Is that right?
Well, in the 1980s, the effort was a little bit early at that point. In the 2004 timeframe, those questions were raised more prominently. But in the early 80s, the interest was to try and get the bulk of the population to be able to move. And the question was, how much time do we really need to be able to give them a warning so that people would leave? And so part of the effort in the early 80s was actually to run computer models at the National Hurricane Center in Miami and figure out for about 50 different storms, if the storm occurred, what kind of wind would occur and what kind of water or flooding would occur, or storm surge would occur. Now, 9 out of 10 people die in storms because of storm surge, because of water, not because of wind. But people generally think of storms as wind-driven events. So it was very important to be able to predict how much water would occur in different places. And then based on that, we were running computer models to figure out how long does it take to evacuate the bulk of the population from these 9 parishes into an area that's safe. The answer was that it takes very long. It takes too long. So all of those efforts, which were this study was part of an effort that was going on all the way in the Gulf Coast states and in the Atlantic Coast states. We found out that wherever there was a large urban center, like let's say Houston or New Orleans or Miami, it just takes very long to evacuate people from from these areas.
It would seem to me that the timeline is driven by the storm itself. In other words, you're going to tell people as soon as you possibly can that it's a very bad storm and it's time to get out. But I guess there are other considerations in terms of people's your own credibility and why the time interval is so important. Tell us more about that.
Yes. So a storm, let's say, develops off of the coast of Africa, Cape Verde, and some of the major storms that have developed and have turned into monster hurricanes have come from there. So the storm starts to cross the Atlantic, of course, as soon as it is a area of low pressure is formed, the National Hurricane Center is on it, and it's trying to understand how it could develop and where it could travel to. And as it starts getting closer to the coastline, there's a greater and greater probability of it striking someplace. And then we have essentially a cone of space where we can say this is where it's expected to land. However, with all of our satellites and all of our computer modeling capabilities, we cannot necessarily predict precisely where the storm is going to landfall and when it's going to landfall. Katrina, on the other hand, was very well predicted. Our prediction capabilities have remarkably improved in the last 20 years. And so even though the storm is about to impact a region, you may not know for certainty, like 48 hours or 50 hours before landfall, maybe at the maximum a 50-50 chance that it's going to strike a specific area. However, if you don't evacuate people until too close to the storm may not actually have landfallen, but you've got wind, you've got water, you've got rain, and you have tides that rise up, and so you cannot evacuate at that point.
They're knocking out roads, they're knocking out communication, so all the things you need to get people out, those are the first to go, and then you've lost even more time. And when you said a long time, well, I mean, what is that long time? What's the interval it would really take to do it right if you had all the time in the world?
So in the early 1980s, when we ran the simulation for New Orleans, we found out that it took 62 hours to evacuate the area, and that's too long. And then if the city waited too long to order an evacuation, so this people leave, of course, they can see the storm coming, they hear the warning from the National Hurricane Center, and they take actions as they take actions. But the bulk of the people tend to leave when the local officials tell them to leave, because we trust our local officials. Even during the major firestorm that we had in Colorado a couple of years ago, when they went back and said, what kind of social media were people listening to? They were listening to the tweets and the messages from the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs and the local emergency management office. So people pay attention to local government and what local government says. So if the local government delayed giving a order for evacuation, which they had us run in the computer model, it took 17 hours longer to evacuate people. And that seems counterintuitive, but actually it makes a lot of sense if you just think about it. If you have 700,000 or so cars within the city and they are not leaving until close to the storm, and now you get an evacuation order, everybody gets in their cars, and you have a massive traffic jam. And people are now at greater risk because they are out in the open, caught in a traffic jam, versus being inside a structure. So this timing of this evacuation, it was very evident in the early 1980s that this was really important.
You created an atlas that thoroughly mapped different types of storms and hurricanes, and it predicted what the aftermath would be. Describe that for us.
So we looked at a number of different scenarios. We looked at 100 years of hurricane history in Louisiana and all the storms that had struck, and then worked with the National Hurricane Center to define 50 stereotypical storms, essentially. And these storms were all coming from different directions, different wind speeds, different intensity, and a different size of the storm, essentially. Forward speed of the storm is also very important. How fast is it traveling? A fast storm is not necessarily bad. A slow storm is bad because a slow storm has time to build up ahead of storm surge ahead of it. So looking at all of those various conditions, we had them run 50 computer simulations, and we analyzed those 50 simulations. And then from that, we developed a heuristic or a rule of thumb for operational use, which was you could just answer three questions and you'd know which scenario you were in. One was, how fast is it traveling, forward speed? Is it small or a large hurricane? And the third one is it coming at me from the east or is it coming at me from the west? When you answer those three questions, it will tell you which of 12 scenarios you were in. And then you could, when you looked at that scenario in the atlas, it would show you the maximum amount of water that you'd get. Didn't talk about wind. Again, I'll go back to what I said before, which is 9 out of 10 deaths occur because of water. So it was really important to tag the water. And to me, what was really important also in the atlas is that we showed flooding above ground level. Because to the point of even Hurricane Sandy last year, we only put out information officially that says flooding above mean sea level or National Geodetic Vertical Datum. Nobody really knows how many feet above the mean sea level or NGDV they are. So it's really important to provide information in a way that's digestible by the public. How much actual flooding would we get?
Well, we'll talk about what that map meant for predicting Hurricane Katrina when our conversation continues with Madhu Beriwal, who is the founder and CEO of Innovative Emergency Management. And our conversation continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today we're meeting Madhu Beriwal. She is the founder and CEO of Innovative Emergency Management. And before the break, we were talking about this atlas that you created that would predict the aftermath of a storm and tell us essentially what was going to happen, how much damage it would do. This was back in the 1980s. Did you put this together?
Yes, 1985.
So this was in 1985. Did it predict what would happen during Hurricane Katrina? If I had had that, would I know how bad that storm was going to be?
Yes. If you looked at the atlas and looked at what it said about that particular scenario, it laid out precisely the kind of problems that we saw and what needed to be done, which is to maximize the evacuation from the area.
Did anybody look at that atlas? Because what we were hearing from the time was nobody knew how serious this storm. We had no idea it was going to have that kind of an effect. But you're saying if they just sort of opened it up, they'd have seen exactly what would have happened.
Well, the atlas had become overcome by events by that time. I think that every single one of the emergency management directors that I had worked with in the early 1980s was not in place anymore by 2005. And so I'm not even sure if those agencies still had a copy of the atlas. I have a copy of the atlas, but I'm not sure that it was in parlance at that point. What we had done, which was very recent, was a hurricane exercise in 2004. And that hurricane exercise was called Hurricane Pam. And that exercise actually, the information from that exercise ended up being used a good bit post-Katrina because it was a scientific bullseye, essentially, in terms of predicting what would happen if a Category 3 storm struck New Orleans.
You've talked about driving through the devastation of Hurricane Katrina shortly after it hit. Tell us about that and how that felt.
It was not possible to go to New Orleans right after Hurricane Katrina struck, if you recall. The city was in lockdown mode, and we spent agonizing days and weeks getting people out of the city and into safe areas. So several weeks after the storm struck, I finally decided to make a pilgrimage to the city, see what had happened. And the storm that I had lived for over 25 years in my mind had actually happened and had profoundly affected me and my company. And, of course, it had profoundly affected a number of people who lost their lives, people who lost their livelihoods, and people who were left homeless. And I drove from Baton Rouge, which is where I was living. It's about a 70-mile drive into the city. And you enter the city, and you feel like all the colors have been sapped out of it. City of New Orleans is a very colorful city. It's always a very lively city. And driving in after Katrina, you could see that the whole place looked like it was a black-and-white movie. It looked like shades of gray, devastation for miles and miles and miles. You could you drive and drive and drive, and you just don't see anything but devastation. I remember passing by a big park. I thought, I don't remember a forest here. What is this place? And all these trees were down, and I suddenly realized it was Audubon Park, beautiful park, and it was devastated. The trees were all down. There were homes that looked abandoned and gray, and every now and then you'd see a person just pulling things out of their home, putting them at the curb. It was a surreal experience. You realize the power of the storm. You realize the power of nature. And you realize what you're battling against when you run those computer models and they show you 15 feet of water. What does 15 feet of water look like a few weeks later? And it was something I understood mentally, but it was quite a shock to see it emotionally, to see what the impact of the storm was on the city.
What were you thinking when you saw it coming? Did you think that this was going to be that storm?
There were a number of storms that I thought this is the storm. In 1989, I think it was Hurricane George, almost became the catastrophic event. In 2004, there was Hurricane Ivan that almost became that event. So there were a number of times where there were near misses, where you watch the storm and say, this could be it. This could be the one.
Tell us about your childhood. You grew up in Kolkata. Is that right?
Yes, I did.
Tell us about that. And I'm interested to know how you came from there and growing up in India and then find yourself sort of planning floodplains and evacuation routes.
So it was very, it was a very strange and different childhood as opposed to what you might think people might go through for the kind of work that I do now. I grew up in a family of six children. I was in the middle, the third child. And I was blessed with a grandfather who was very interested in education and particularly education of women. He had been involved in the independence movement of India. As you know, Mahatma Gandhi was one of the leading proponent. Of course, I did not have a chance to meet him. He was killed prior to my being born. I do remember one of his teacher, his acharya, Vinoba Bhave, actually visited our home one day. It was very early in the morning, and we were all told to get dressed and hold out garlands and respect him when he came in. And, you know, we were not terribly happy because it was, I think, 4:30 in the morning or some such hour. But had the pleasure of seeing somebody who was involved in the independence of India. And my grandfather believed that if you could sit on your bottom, you were ready for education. Mm. And so when each one of us reached the age of 6 months, we had a tutor that came and taught us two different languages, English and Hindi, so that we could learn the alphabet and we could learn the words. And he was the one who made sure that he looked at our grades and signed report cards had to be signed by the guardian, and he was the guardian as far as our education was concerned. So he would sign for us, so he was very instrumental in that. Growing up, I was very fond of maps. I love maps. I still love maps. And my father used to travel a lot, so I would ask him the other kids would ask him for other things, which he would always forget to bring because he was a very forgetful person. But he would remember what I asked for because I always asked for maps. And so on the flight coming back, he'd think about all the things he had not bought, but he could still bring the in-flight map for me. It was a wonderful childhood. I got to meet Mother Teresa. She lived in Calcutta, and I went to a school that raised money for her charity. So we would have these events where we would raise funds, and then Mother Teresa would come in. And I have to tell you, Frank, that you could feel her soul enter the room. So this was an all-girls school. There was 400 or 500 of us in an assembly hall, everybody shuffling their feet. And she was a very small woman. When she entered the room, you could feel the power of her personality. And she would always make all of us cry because she talked about the lepers and the people that she was helping and how much this money was going to help them. So that was a signature moment for me because I listened to her and I thought, I don't have the spirit of sacrifice to do what she has done, but I would like to make my life worthwhile. And that's what led me to try and leave India, because I wanted control of my own life.
That's a personal drive, but I want to get back to your grandfather, who believed in education but also educating women. Was that unusual at the time, and did he or you encounter any resistance to that?
It was very unusual at that time. So I grew up in a household that was built by my great-grandfather, who traveled from northwestern India, which is where our family is from, to Calcutta, which is clear across the country. And at that time, it would be equivalent to somebody going to the moon at this point. And he started a business there and built this house. And all of his extended family lived there. So I lived in a house with 200 people.
Wow.
There were about 30-plus kids growing up, which was fantastic if you wanted to create two cricket teams or or two baseball teams.
Or write plays, as apparently.
Or write plays. We wrote a lot of plays. We produced a lot of plays growing up in the house, and we had a lot of fun. But of the 15 or 16 or so girls that were there in that household, only my sisters and I graduated from high school. So there was not an emphasis on the education of women, even at that time. Each one of us forged a path that made space for the next one. My oldest sister was the first one to go to college. My second sister was the first one in college to do the honors program, which was considered too intensive for a woman to study. And then I was the third one, and I went in to do geography honors, which was not considered a womanly discipline because you're not studying literature. So it was a, even for us, with the emphasis on education, there was still somewhat of a friction point on what we could do with that education.
And why did you decide then to come to the United States once you had your education?
Once I was in college, I realized that my life was set for me. I could see the path ahead, which was that I would finish my education, I would be married, I'd go from my father's house to my husband's house, I'd go from my father's care to my husband's care, and I would not have a chance to live a life that I wanted. And I would not have control over my own life. And that started creating dissonance in my mind of, is this what I want for myself? And that is not what I wanted for myself. So I started agitating to leave. It took about a year of strife. And it was one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life, is to actually leave the country that I knew and travel by myself to the United States.
And you did. And interestingly enough, you met a lot of resistance here as well, as an educated woman who should by now, you would think, be able to sort of prove herself by her own achievements. But not so.
There's not been as much pushback, I think, in my life here. I think this country has been wonderful for me to be in. I've had no barriers that have prevented me from doing things that I want to do. The only barriers have been my own ability and my own willingness to do things. So I don't think that I have been able to explore the end. You know, when you get to the edge of a map, it says, there be dragons here. I have not seen any dragons as yet.
Now, interestingly enough, when you got here, I understand that your father only allowed you to live in the Midwest once you finally convinced them that you could leave India. Is that right?
Right. So I came here in 1978. And if you remember, Son of Sam was killing women in New York City. And he was killing brunettes particularly. So my father was convinced that since I am a brunette, that Son of Sam was going to find me. So he said, you can't go to the East Coast because that's where the Son of Sam is. And the West Coast was going to fall off into the ocean any day with an earthquake. And the South was too hot and the North was too cold. So he said, I will let you go, but you can only go in the middle of the country. So I applied to Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma.
Apparently you never saw The Wizard of Oz. They have tornadoes there in Kansas. You know?
Well, that's right. That's exactly where I ended up, in the land of tornadoes and The Wizard of Oz. I landed at the University of Kansas.
How are things for you there? What did you study there?
I had just finished a degree in geography and economics in India. But what I really wanted to study was urban settlements. I wanted to see how policy decisions made at a city level or at a regional level affect the actions of individual actors like home buyers and speculators and investors, and how a city grows from there as a powerful entity that outlasts, different millennia in some cases. And so I wanted to study urban planning, and I got a master's degree in urban planning from the University of Kansas.
You talked about some of the stereotypes that your father may have had about the U.S. in terms of crime and weather and vulnerability to earthquake. But then you faced stereotypes here, did you not, and when you found yourself in the American heartland?
Well, there was one incident. By and large, people were extremely welcoming. And if I had any issues, they were more small technical issues like, how do you navigate yourself in a cafeteria and how do you use a vending machine, things that were not common in India at
that
time.
I'm still trying to figure that stuff out, so good luck.
Well, yes, I learned. Don't put the money in the vending machine, then you don't have a problem right there.
That's the right answer.
So, but in 1979, a year after I was at college, I was coming back from the library late at night, one night, and the American hostage crisis had started in Iran. And I was surrounded by a group of students who perhaps had had a little too much to drink, and they mistook me for an Iranian woman, and they were going to beat me up. And it was quite startling. I kept trying to explain to them that I was not from Iran, while I felt guilty about saying that because, you know, you're not responsible for what happens in the country that you're from. So I could very well have been from Iran. But fortunately for me, one of the girls in the group said, just leave her alone. And they let me go. So that was my one incident of being concerned or being worried.
What made you decide to start your own company?
In 1980, I graduated from the University of Kansas. And I had a couple of job offers. By that time, I'd moved to Louisiana, and I had a couple of job offers, one in healthcare policy and the other one in floodplain management. And because I love maps, I love spatial problems, I thought floodplain management seemed a lot more interesting than healthcare policy. So I took the job on to deal with floodplain management, and from there on, went on to work on the hurricane evacuation study.
So you're working, but then that's a bit of a leap from that to take a job like that than to start your own company.
Well, yes, it was. So when I took the job to be the program manager for the hurricane evacuation study, I had to give up my full-time civil service job to do that. And they warned me. They said, well, if you take this job, it's grant-funded. When the grant runs out, your job will run out. I thought, well, okay, I still want to do it. So I took the job, and oftentimes in my life, I think of it as jumping off a cliff. You know, you come to a point where you get to the end of what you're doing, and there's a cliff at the end of it, and you have a choice. Do I turn back and go the route that I've traversed already, or do I jump off the cliff and hope the wings will sprout? And I have learned to trust that if you jump, the wings will sprout and you will land and safe ground and a more interesting ground, perhaps even. So I took the job, and then, of course, when the study ended, I didn't have a job. So that was 1985. I just finished doing the Atlas as the capstone of the work. And I thought, well, this was fascinating. I want to do this the rest of my life. And somebody said, well, you're talking about being a contractor. I said, well, okay, then I will be a contractor. And created the company. I named it Innovative Emergency Management because I really believe, and I believe now, that innovation is needed to solve the kind of complex problems that we see in disaster management, particularly so in homeland security. We need innovation to be able to solve these complex, what I call wicked problems. And spent one day creating 25 logos and then selected one of those to be the logo of the company, and that's still our logo today.
Well, I know there's a story about how that logo was selected. We're going to take a break right now, come back and hear that story and more as our conversation continues with Madhu Berrywal, who is the founder and CEO of Innovative Emergency Management. Stay with us on the State of Things. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking with Madhu Berrywal. She is the founder and CEO of Innovative Emergency Management, a company whose logo you can see if you go to our website, and we'll link you to it. But there's a story about how it came about. You had a lot to choose from. Tell us the story.
I spent about a day coming up with about 25 logos. So one of the reasons why this was easy is because I learned art growing up, and all of us sisters paint to some degree or the other. And so it was not a big stretch to sit down and say, okay, let me design some logos for myself. And so I designed 25 different logos, and when my husband came home, I said, don't think about it. Just look at the logos and see which one strikes you. And he pointed to one of them, which is the logo that we have today. So to describe this logo, it's really the idea behind it was that we need both forward progress and industry and economy, and as well as community. And how do you meld them together? And so the logo shows a smokestack representative of industry and progress and economy, and then two flat rooftops that are the tops of homes. And the two of them are together in a circle, which denotes a community, a sustainable community. So a way of living that coordinates both the economic and the social together. And it's red because that's the color of emergencies.
You talked about emergency management as the field that you're in. You pursued it for most of your professional life. And you said that there's something about where you grew up, the idea of sort of living in the face of danger, in a sense, or imminent disaster, that may well have directed you in this way. Tell us about it.
Calcutta is a city like New Orleans. It's a deltaic city, so it is at the end of the Ganges River, just like New Orleans is at the end of the Mississippi River, and so you have cyclones there. Same thing as hurricanes here that form, and I had experienced those. A lot of devastation. Right next to Calcutta, the adjoining country is Bangladesh. Is struck by cyclones very often, and people die in these cyclones just because there isn't a good system of forecasting, wasn't at that time, of being able to forecast and provide warnings to people. So I experienced that. I saw a lot of flooding in Calcutta. Calcutta tends to flood every monsoon season. So I saw a lot of flooding in Calcutta. So I was familiar with these various disasters and their impacts on people.
In the summer of 2001, you were part of a science board that was employed to look at how information was tracked during terrorism. As of the summer of 2001, tell us about that.
So in late 2000, actually, I was asked to serve on the Defense Science Board. And the Defense Science Board is a group of people that look at complex problems that affect various parts of the Department of Defense. And so I was asked to serve as a member of a panel. And subsequently, many years later, I've been a member on the Army Science Board. But that particular event for the DSB, the Defense Science Board, we were looking at how intelligence is gathered against terrorism. The Hart-Rudman report had just come out. That report had, as the opening paragraph had said, a spectacular terrorist event will occur on U.S. soil in the next 25 years. And so our charter was to look at what was being done on intelligence gathering. And we had a lot of briefings from all of the different three-letter agencies on how they conducted business. And we took all of that. We saw all of the problems, that the fact that only 3% of the cargo was being inspected, the borders were porous. We had allowances for some countries where they did not have to have a visa to enter the United States. We saw all of the various issues that we are now familiar with, and we wrote our report in the summer of 2001 and sent it in to the Department of Defense for their review. And 2 months later, there was 9/11.
When you were doing all of this, I mean, it's one thing just to read a kind of a summary and says in the next 25 years, spectacular event. Yeah, yeah. How open were you to the idea that something like this might really happen?
I don't think I can tell you. We did not sense, or at least I did not sense when we were working on this, that it was that imminent. We had all the briefings. We looked at all of the data. We put the report together with a number of recommendations, most of which have been implemented now. But I cannot tell you that I felt that it was that, that we were at the 11th hour. There was not that sense of impending doom that I had with the hurricane striking New Orleans.
I wonder, a few months later, when it finally happened and you had closed the book on this report, what your thoughts were at that time?
My overwhelming emotion was guilt. I felt that we had not shouted loudly enough. Although, again, I have to go back and say we didn't think we were that close to an actual event.
But this is an interesting question, one you face all the time in terms of warning, evacuation, getting people to leave. It's the railroad crossing question, right? If the bar goes down too soon and holds traffic back for too long, we lose credibility. We say, oh, they always warn that. People drive around it. Of course, if it's too late, cars get smashed. And so the question of precisely how long that bar should be down to block traffic is a key one. The same is true for evacuation and how people perceive risk and whether or not you're credible. Isn't that a big part of what you do and have to consider?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at what happened in Katrina and Rita, Rita occurred 10, 14 days after Katrina, and it struck the other part of Louisiana and parts of Texas. So we had, by some accounts, not enough evacuation in Katrina. And so when Rita occurred, there was over-evacuation, and people were caught up in traffic jams. Some people died. There's really a sad story of people that died in Hurricane Rita. So when you have an event that occurs and the public is concerned that not enough people evacuated, the next time you're going to have too much. Well, then after a while, a few years pass by and people forget about all of that. Now it's very hard to get them to move again. So this is really, this is a place where the whole cry wolf story really applies very much. You have to be cognizant of what people are thinking and how they might react to it.
This came home personally to you when you were working on Hurricane Pam. You had a family emergency back in Calcutta. Tell us about it.
It's something that you never want to face. We had started working on a project called Hurricane Pam. It was actually catastrophic planning for the United States. And it was really the first attempt in modern times to really look at the catastrophes that could occur place by place and develop a plan for it. And we had won that contract, and the first place selected was New Orleans. It was actually under the leadership of somebody who was from North Carolina, Eric Tolbert, who was a North Carolina Emergency Management Director and subsequently went up to work for FEMA. And he was in charge and he was concerned about catastrophic planning being done well. So in 2004, we won this contract, got started, and they gave us 54 days to put together a alluring, detailed scenario, a really graphic scenario of what could happen if a Category 3 storm struck New Orleans. Now, Category 3 storm, mind you, you have storms from Category 1 to 5, 5 being the worst. So Category 3 storm is not that bad, but it is the threshold of a catastrophic event. And so that's the storm that we were looking at. We took Hurricane Ivan that had occurred the year before and almost hit New Orleans and previous other storms and created a track working with the National Hurricane Center that would cause maximum impact on New Orleans. The first exercise, the exercise was a one-week exercise. It started July 16th. And on July 4th, my sister passed away in India. She had cancer and had been battling it for a while. There was a power outage in Calcutta, which is very common, and she needed oxygen. They couldn't get the oxygen open in time, and she passed away. And I was in Montana at that point. I got the call that she had passed away. I didn't have my passport with me and realized that by the time I came back to Louisiana and collected my passport and took the 36-hour journey to India, I would not see her, that the funeral would have happened by that time. And then there was this Hurricane Pam exercise that was on the 16th of July. I really felt that this time, that the time had run out and it was going to happen, that New Orleans was going to get a major hit. And I felt a sense of great responsibility that I needed to be there for this event. And so I decided not to go to India stay here in the United States, complete the exercise, and then go right after that to grieve for my sister with the rest of the family. It's not a decision that you are ever comfortable with, and I would never question anybody that decided the opposite way. Mm. But it's a job conflict that a lot of people face in emergency management, where they have to put either their family or their position one or the other ahead.
But that kind of speculation and the guessing that you had to do around these very personal issues, in some ways, isn't that at the heart of some of the choices people make when they're asked to evacuate? Should I stay here and protect what's here, my family here? Do I go away? And think about all of the priorities all against a guess about how bad things might really be over and against what it is we're seeing on the maps.
Absolutely. I think that's very well said. People make their own decisions. So in emergency management, oftentimes we think that we tell somebody to leave and they'll just immediately jump into their cars and leave. And that's not the case at all. Every family, every unit decides on their own. Are we going to leave? Does it make sense to leave? And I'll tell you a way that this makes it very clear. Max Mayfield, who was the director of the National Hurricane Center when Katrina hit, he said that Hurricane Camille, by the way, Hurricane Camille occurred in 1969. He said Hurricane Camille killed more people in Hurricane Katrina than it did in 1969, because people were basing decisions on what happened in Camille. Well, this house was standing in Camille. It was left standing in Camille. So we are safe here, because people are trying to make the right choices for themselves and for their families, and then you have a situation where you, after a while, you don't have a choice. So in these situations, what I really tell people is they need to take the course of least regret. What is the course of least regret at this point? If you leave and your house is damaged and you are not there to protect it, at least you have saved yourself and your family.
So getting back to your personal story and thinking about the fact that you left India, you violated some cultural norms in a way. You didn't settle down with that husband and become, allowing him to make the decisions for you. I don't know what kind of stress that placed on the family. But then when they made that phone call and you had to give the answer that you did, how did that go?
It was a difficult call. I felt very torn. I still do. And to me, when I have this sort of dissonance, I tried to do something about it. And so when I went back to India, my sister's daughter, my niece, sings beautifully. So I had her go to a professional studio and make a CD of hymns for my sister to commemorate her life and to recognize what she had created in her life, which was her children and the life for them. And that was my way of paying homage to her.
And I understand that your sister, was she in the audience? You were giving a speech.
Well, I have three sisters. Uh-huh. So my second sister passed away in 2004. Last year, I was given an award by the Women in Homeland Security and Emergency Management for IEM, for creating a homeland security company run by a woman. And my sister, my younger sister, said, "I'm coming to the award ceremony." I said, "You know, it's not a big deal. really shouldn't come. And she said, oh, this is a very big deal for me, and I want to come, and I want my family to come with me. So she came over. This ceremony was in Orlando at the same time as the International Association for Emergency Management Conference. And I was giving a speech there, and I thought quite a bit about it because I don't often have a chance to have my family members as audience when I'm speaking. And I really wanted to connect us together, the sisters together, that the sister that had gone away and the sister that was here for me. And I started, I really laid down a challenge for emergency management at that speech. So I have been talking more and more about this concept of let's focus on saving lives because that's what matters.
Did having your sister in the audience for that speech change the speech that you gave?
Yes, it did, because I had to think about what is it that I wanted to do. It gave sort of a longitudinal view of what I had done so far, and I recognize I have a platform. I have an ability to say something that can have some effect, and I should say it. And the most important thing that I have to say is that we can do things to save lives during disasters, and we should figure out what those things are and do them.
Madhu, what a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for being here.
You're quite welcome, Frank. Thank you.
Madhu Beriwal is the founder and CEO of Innovative Emergency Management. Thanks for listening to The State of Things. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.